look at the manufacturer's submission, he said in a very soft voice which I could scarcely hear, you will see that the quality of life data wasn't collected because the clinicians running the trial felt it would be bad for the patient's welfare. It's a standard problem with cancer chemotherapy trials. It's difficult to get dying patients to complete questionnaires. One has to use standard utilities instead. But it's one of the few chemotherapy agents we have for this cancer that has very few side effects, he added. He spoke movingly of the difficulties of treating dying patients and the fact that he had so few effective treatments. We would very much like to have the choice of using this drug, he concluded. At any cost? The chairman asked, delivering the coup de grace. The expert had no answer to this terrible question. Once the discussion had ended, the patient representatives and experts and outside observers were then ushered out of the room, and the second part of the meeting, where a decision is made whether to allow the NHS to use the drug or not, but in camera, started. Surely, I wanted to say to the hard-nosed health economists and public health doctors around me, but did not dare, the real utility of the drug is to give dying patients hope, the hope that they might be statistical outliers and live longer than average. How do you measure the utility of hope? I could have delivered an impassioned lecture on the subject. I have spent much time talking to people whose life was coming to an end. Healthy people, I have concluded, including myself, do not understand how everything changes once you have been diagnosed with a fatal illness. How you cling to hope, however false, however slight, and how reluctant most doctors are to deprive patients of that fragile beam of light in so much darkness. Indeed, many people develop what psychiatrists call dissociation, and a doctor can find himself talking to two people. They know that they are dying, and yet they still hope that they will live. I had noticed the same phenomenon with my mother during the last few days of her life. When faced by people who are dying, you are no longer dealing with the rational consumers assumed by economic model builders, if they ever existed in the first place. Hope is beyond price, and the pharmaceutical companies, which are run by businessmen, not altruists, price their products accordingly. The admirable purpose of NICE's technology appraisal, which is only one part of NICE's work, is to try to provide a countervailing force to the pharmaceutical company's pricing policies. The methodology used for the drug in question was unrealistic, verging on the absurd, and I wondered how many of the people sitting around the hollow square understood the difficulties and deceptions involved in treating patients who were dying, where the real value of a drug such as this one is hope, and not the statistical probability of living, possibly in great pain, for an average of an extra 5 months. I kept my doubts to myself, since I firmly believe that the pricing policies of the great drug companies must be resisted, and that healthcare costs, like greenhouse gases, must be curbed. The abstract discussion continued. But the MS doesn't involve a PSA, a young health economist was saying with deep indignation. And if you want my opinion, we should toss this application out. Surely not prostate-specific antigen, I asked my neighbour, unable to resist a silly joke. No, he said. Probabilistic sensitivity analysis. Well, I have some problems with PSAs, the chairman said, but the assumptions about the hack slope are important, and the lowest possible ISA is £150,000, so even though EOL applies, there is no way this drug will pass. At a cost of £40,000 per year for treatment per patient, there was never any chance it could be cost-effective. This last one, at least, was an acronym I knew. End of life was a compromise NICE had recently been forced to make to allow the use of expensive drugs in small groups of patients dying from rare cancers. The discussion went on interminably. Half of my fellow committee members spoke and argued in the arcane language of cost-effectiveness analysis with passion and assurance, while the other half nodded wisely. Did they really understand all this? I felt ashamed by my ignorance. Eventually, the chairman looked round the committee. "I think we're looking at a minded no here, are we not?" he said. "What this means is that the committee's recommendation will go out to consultation, and all the interested parties, patient groups, manufacturers, clinicians, can criticize and comment before a final conclusion is reached. NICE bends over backwards to be transparent and to involve all the stakeholders involved in its deliberations and its portrayal in the media. Besides, it is just possible that the pharmaceutical company who make the drug might reduce the price." I took the train back to London that afternoon and arrived back at Euston at 7 in the evening. I walked the 2 miles to Waterloo in the dark January evening, and along with hundreds of commuters crossed the bridge over the oil-black river, the city to either side of us made wonderful by millions of electric lights glittering in the night over snow-covered roofs. It was good to escape, if only for a few hours. The world of disease and death in which I spend so much of my life. Chapter 24. Oligodendroglioma. Noun, a tumour of the central nervous system. It was Sunday evening, and there were 3 patients with brain tumours on the operating list for the next day. A woman my own age with a slowly growing meningioma, a young doctor with an oligodendroglioma that I had already operated on some years earlier, which was now growing back again, and which we both knew would ultimately prove fatal, and an emergency admission whom I had not yet seen. I took my bicycle to the hospital's basement entrance, next to the wheelie bins where the nurses sometimes come to smoke cigarettes. The door's lock seems to be permanently broken, so I can enter the building and take my bike up in the service lift to the back of the operating theatres, where I then leave it and go to see my patients. I went to the women's ward first to find the woman with the meningioma. I met one of the senior sisters, a friend for many years, coming down the corridor. She had a coat on and must have finished her shift. She was almost in tears. I put my hand out to her. "Oh, it's hopeless," she said. "We've got so many staff shortages this week, and all we can get at night are agency nurses who are worse than useless. And the news has all these stories about bad nursing care, but what can we do about it?" I looked at the whiteboard on the wall beside the nurse's station, which lists all the patients on the ward. The patients are moved around so continually because of the lack of beds that the board is rarely up to date, and finding patients is often very difficult. I could not see my patient's name on the list. There was a group of nurses who were laughing and shouting by the desk, and as far as I could tell, what they were discussing had nothing to do with the patients. "Where's Mrs. Cowdrey, the patient for tomorrow's list?" I asked. One of the agency nurses looked briefly at me and then pulled out a printed sheet of paper from her pocket, which listed all the patients. She looked at it uncertainly, shrugged her shoulders and mumbled something. "Who's in charge?" I asked. "Chris. Where is she? She's on a break." "Do you have any idea where Mrs. Cowdrey might be?" "No," she said with a shrug. So I walked down the corridor to the men's ward, which has some side rooms in which female patients are occasionally placed. I found a nurse whom, to my relief, I did recognise, one of the many Filipino nurses in the department, whose friendly and gentle nursing skills cannot be too highly praised. "Ah, Gilbert," I said.